and the race was on. Lash bounded to the lead, with Bright in pursuit. Louis dropped back. In the Zamperini house, a throng crouched around the radio. They were in agony. Louis' start time had passed, but the announcer was lingering on the swimming trials. Pete was so frustrated he considered putting his foot through the radio. At last, the announcer listed the positions of the 5,000-meter runners. He didn't mention Louis. Overwhelmed, Louise fled to the kitchen. Lash and Bright led the runners through laps 7, 8, 9. Louis hovered mid-pack, waiting to make his move. The heat was suffocating. One runner collapsed, and the others hurdled him. Another dropped, and they jumped him too. Louis could feel his feet cooking as the spikes on his shoes conducted heat up from the track. Bright's feet were burning particularly badly. In terrible pain, he took a staggering step off the track and twisted his ankle, then lurched back on. Louis passed him, and he had no resistance to offer. As the runners entered the final lap, Louis accelerated, closing in on Lash. Looking at the bobbing head of the mighty Don Lash, Louis felt intimidated. For several strides, he hesitated. Then he saw the last curve ahead. He opened up as fast as he could go. Banking around the turn, Louis drew alongside Lash, and the two ran side by side down the home stretch. Neither man had any more speed to give, and neither could get past the other. Exhausted, straining, with heads thrown back and legs moving in sync, they hit the line together. The announcer's voice echoed across the living room in torrents. "Zamperini," he said, "had won." In the kitchen, Louise heard the crowd in the next room suddenly shout. Outside, car horns honked, the front door swung open, and neighbors gushed in. As a crush of hysterical torrencers celebrated around her, Louise wept happy tears. Anthony poured wine and sang out toasts. Louise's voice came over the airwaves, calling a greeting to Torrance. The announcer was mistaken. The judges ruled Lash the winner. The announcer corrected himself, but it hardly dimmed the revelry in Torrance. A few minutes later, Louis stood under a cold shower. His feet were burned, the marks following the patterns of his spikes. After drying off, he weighed himself. He'd sweated off 3 pounds. Norman Bright was slumped on a bench, staring at his foot. It, like the other one, was burned so badly that the skin had peeled off. He'd finished 5th. By day's end, Louis had received some 125 telegrams. "Torrance has gone nuts," read one. "Village has gone screwy," read another. There was even one from the Torrance police, who must have been relieved that someone else was chasing Louis. Louis pored over photos of his race in the evening papers. In some, he appeared tied with Lash, in others, he appeared to be in front. On the track, he'd felt sure he'd won. The top 3 finishers would go to Berlin, but Louis felt cheated nonetheless. As Louis studied the papers, the judges were reviewing photos and a film of the 5,000. Later, Louis telegrammed the news home. "Judges called it a tie. We'll run harder in Berlin." The Zamperini's house was packed with well-wishers and newsmen. Anthony drank toasts until 4 in the morning. Pete walked around to back slaps. "Am I ever happy," he wrote to Louis. "I have to go around with my shirt open so that I have enough room for my chest." Louis Zamperini was going to compete in the Olympics in an event he'd run only 4 times. He was the youngest distance runner to ever make the team. Chapter 4. Plundering Germany. The ship bearing the Olympic team to Germany wasn't long at sea before Louis began stealing. In his defense, it wasn't he who started it. Self-conscious about being a teenaged upstart, he at first curbed his coltish impulses and began growing a mustache. but he soon noticed that practically everyone was souvenir collecting. The mustache was abandoned, and Louis joined the other light fingers in denuding the ship. On pitching seas, training was chaotic. Basketball players did passing drills on deck, but the wind kept jettisoning the balls into the Atlantic. The water in the ship's pools sloshed back and forth violently, and big swells heaved the water and everyone in it onto the deck, so the coaches tied the swimmers to the wall. Gymnasts fell off their apparatuses, fencers lurched all over the ship. Louis and the other runners trotted around, dodging deck chairs. In high seas, they all staggered in one direction, then the other. For a poor kid accustomed to stale bread and milk for breakfast, the ship was paradise. Food and beverages were everywhere in amazing abundance. Louis devoured everything. In the dining room, he plowed through anything the seasick athletes couldn't stomach. Discovering a shot putter with a tiny appetite, he began sitting with him, dropping onto his plate like a vulture the moment the shot putter was full. On the first-class deck, he found a window in which pints of beer kept magically appearing. He made them magically disappear. One night, Louis jotted down what he had just eaten. 1 pint of pineapple juice, 2 bowls of beef broth, 2 sardine salads, 5 rolls, 2 tall glasses of milk, 4 small sweet pickles, 2 plates of chicken, 2 helpings of sweet potatoes, 4 pieces of butter, 3 helpings of ice cream with wafers, 3 chunks of angel food cake with white frosting, 1.5 pounds of cherries, 1 apple, 1 orange. "Biggest meal I ever ate in my life," he wrote. "Where it all went, I don't know." He soon found out. When the ship docked, a doctor weighed Louis. In 9 days, he'd gained 12 pounds. The Olympic Village was breathtaking. Nestled among forests and lakes were 140 beautiful cottages, a shopping mall, a barber shop, a post office, a dentist's office, a sauna, training facilities, and dining halls. A new technology called television was on exhibit. Imported animals bounded over wooded trails. Someone wondered aloud where the storks were. The next day, 200 storks appeared. Louis and the other Olympians were driven through Berlin for the opening ceremonies. Adolf Hitler and his militaristic, ferociously anti-Semitic Nazi party were in power, and their presence was everywhere. Swastikas papered the city. Soldiers drilled and military gliders swooped over oceans of uniformed kids called Hitler Youth. Gypsies and Jewish students had vanished. The gypsies dumped in camps, the Jews confined to the University of Berlin campus. The only visible sign of discord was the broken glass in the windows of Jewish businesses. Entering the Olympic Stadium, the athletes were treated to a thunderous show, culminating in the release of 20,000 doves. With the birds circling in panicked confusion, cannons fired, prompting the startled birds to relieve themselves in a shower over the athletes. Louis stood at attention, shaking with laughter. As Louis prepared for his race, he knew he had no shot at a medal. It wasn't just that he was almost pudgy from idleness and overeating. Few nations dominated an Olympic event as Finland did the 5,000. Finn Lauri Lehtinen, the 1932 gold medalist, was back, along with his Swift teammates Gunnar Hökert and Ilmari Salminen. Louis was too young and green to beat the Finns. His day would come, he believed, in the 1500 in 1940. An envelope arrived from Pete. Inside were 2 playing cards, a joker and an ace. On the joker, Pete had written, "Which are you going to be, the joker, which is another word for horse's ass, or the tops, ace of spades? Take your choice." On the ace, he'd written, Let's see you storm through as the best in the deck. On August 7th, Louis lay in the Olympic Stadium infield readying himself for his race. 100,000 spectators ringed the track. Louis was terrified. He buried his face in the grass, inhaling deeply, trying to settle his nerves. When the time came, he walked to the starting line, bowed forward, and waited. At the sound of the gun, Louis's body, electric with nervous energy, wanted to bolt, but Louis made a conscious effort to relax. As the pace setters surged forward, he kept his stride short. Don Lash emerged with the lead, the three Finns behind him. Louis settled into the second tier of runners. Louis smelled a sickening odor, the hair pomade of a runner ahead. Feeling nauseous, he slowed, letting the pomaded runner pull away. The laps wound by, and Louis kept losing ground. Lash and the Finns were slipping out of reach, and Louis wanted to go with them, but his body felt heavy. He slipped to 12th. Ahead, the Finns sidled into Lash, roughing him up. On the 8th lap, Salminen rammed his elbow into Lash's chest. Lash folded abruptly, in evident pain. The Finns bounded away. They entered the 11th lap together, looking to sweep the medals. Then, for an instant, they strayed too close. Their legs tangled, and Salminen fell heavily to the track. His race, like Lash's, was lost. Louis saw none of it. He passed Lash, but it meant little. He was tired and so far behind. Then he found himself thinking of something Pete once said. A lifetime of glory is worth a moment of pain. Louis thought, let go. With one lap to go, Louis fixed his eyes on the gleaming head of the pomaded runner far ahead. He began a dramatic acceleration. Around the turn and down the backstretch, Louis kicked, his legs reaching and pushing, his speed dazzling. One by one, runners came up ahead and faded behind. As Louis flew around the last bend, Hookert had already won. Louis wasn't watching him. He was chasing the glossy head, still distant. He heard a roar and realized the crowd was cheering him on. Even Hitler watched him. Louis ran. Pete's words beating in his head, his whole body burning. The shining hair was distant, then nearer, then so close that Louis again smelled the pomade. With the last of his strength, he threw himself over the line. Louis had clocked by far the fastest 5,000-meter run by an American in 1936, almost 12 seconds faster than Lash's best for the year. He'd just missed 7th place. As he bent, gasping over his spent legs, he marveled at the kick he'd forced from his body. It had felt very, very fast. Two coaches hurried up, gaping at their stopwatches. In 1930s elite distance running, it was exceptionally rare for a man to run a last lap in 60 seconds, even at a mile. In the 5,000, well over 3 miles, a final lap in less than 70 seconds was astounding. Louis had run his last lap in 56 seconds. After cleaning up, Louis climbed into the stands near Hitler's box. Someone pointed out a ghoulish man and said it was Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda. Louis, who knew nothing about the Nazis, had never heard of him. He carried his camera to Goebbels and asked if he'd snap Hitler's picture. Goebbels asked his name and event, then took the camera, moved away, snapped a photo, and returned. Hitler, he said, wanted to see him. Goebbels led Louis to Hitler. The Führer bent from his box, smiled, and offered his hand. Louis had to reach far up. Their fingers barely touched. Hitler spoke. An interpreter translated. Ah, you're the boy with the fast finish. Itching to raise hell, Louis donned his Olympic dress uniform and went out with a friend. They prowled bars, sarcastically chirped, "Heil Hitler!" at everyone in uniform, and stole anything they could pry loose. In an automat, they discovered German beer. By the time he finished his second liter, Louis was feeling very brave. Trolling around Berlin, they stopped at the Chancellery, the building housing Hitler's office. A car pulled up and out stepped Hitler, who walked inside. On the building, Louis spotted a Nazi flag that he thought would make a swell souvenir. The banner didn't yet carry much symbolic meaning for him, or many other Americans in 1936. Louis just had a hankering to steal in his head and 2 persuasive liters of beer in his belly. Watching the guards pacing before the Chancellery, Louis noted that on each pass there was a point at which both had their backs to the flag. As they turned, Louis ran to the flag and began jumping, trying to grab it. The guards spotted him. Louis took a last leap, snagged the flag's edge, and fell, tearing the banner down with him. He scrambled to his feet and ran like mad. He heard a crack. Looking back, he saw a guard running at him, his gun pointed up, yelling, "Halten Sie!" Louis stopped. The guard spun him around, saw his Olympic uniform, hesitated, and asked Louis his name. The one thing Louis knew about Nazis was that they were anti-Semitic, so he gave his name in an exaggeratedly Italian fashion. The guards summoned an official, who asked Louis why he'd stolen the flag. Louis, laying it on thick, said he wanted a souvenir of the happy time he'd had in beautiful Germany. The Germans gave him the flag and let him go. When the press heard of Louis's adventure, reporters took creative liberties. Louis had stormed Hitler's palace to steal the flag in a hail of bullets. Plunging 18 feet, he'd raced away, pursued by 2 columns of guards who tackled and beat him. Just as a rifle butt had been about to crush Louis's head, the German army's commander-in-chief had halted the attack, and Louis had talked the general into sparing his life. In one version, Hitler himself allowed him to keep the flag. Louis had done it all, went the story, to win the heart of a girl. When Louis arrived in Torrance, he was plunked on a throne and paraded downtown, where 4,000 people, whipped up by a band, sirens, and whistles, cheered. Louis shook hands and grinned. "I didn't only start too slow," he joked. "I ran too slow." As he settled into home, he thought of his future. Running the 1936 Olympic 5000 at 19 on 4 races experience had been a shot at the moon. Running the 1940 Olympic 1500 at 23 after years of training would be another matter. The same thought was circling Pete's mind. Louis could win gold in 1940. Officials had just announced which city would host the 1940 Games. Louis shaped his dreams around Tokyo, Japan. Chapter 5. The Red Circle. At USC, Louis spent mornings in class and afternoons training. In the evenings, he and his teammates wedged into his 31 Ford and drove to Torrance for Louise Zamperini's spaghetti. In his spare time, Louis crashed society weddings, worked as a movie extra, and harassed his housemates with practical jokes, replacing their deviled ham with cat food and milk with a laxative. He pursued girls by all means necessary, once landing a date by hurling himself into a girl's car, then pretending to have been struck. On the track, he was unstoppable. Focused on the 1940 Tokyo Olympics, he smashed record after record. By spring of 38, he'd whittled his mile time down to 4 minutes 13.7 seconds, some 7 seconds off of the world record, which now stood at 4 minutes 6.4 seconds. "There's the next mile champion," said Glenn Cunningham to reporters one afternoon. "When he concentrates on this distance, he'll be unbeatable." The reporters turned to see who Cunningham was looking at. It was Louis, blushing to the roots of his hair. In the 1930s, runners were beginning to toss around the idea of a four-minute mile. Most observers, including Cunningham, had long believed it couldn't be done.